I'm David Remnick, and each week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, my colleagues and I unpack what's happening in a very complicated world. You'll hear from the New Yorker's award-winning reporters and thinkers, Jelani Cobb on race and justice, Jill Lepore on American history, Vincent Cunningham and Gia Tolentino on culture, Bill McKibben on climate change, and many more. To get the context behind events in the news, listen to the New Yorker Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
The Russian military is gaining ground in Ukraine. The Biden administration is throwing some of the blame on Republicans and Congress.
We are gravely concerned.
I'm Carolyn Buehler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Also, a school in Ukraine where students go to classes in subway tunnels.
Before the war, I used underground like some kind of transport.
And is China's real estate market too big to fail?
When China takes the big hit, as it has because of this real estate slowdown, it will be felt everywhere.
In Venezuela, signs of a new political crackdown.
Plus, we know about whale song, but how whales sing? Only now are scientists looking at their voice box.
You know, it's big as a medium-sized dog. It's a big lump of tissue.
All that and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Buehler. Thank you for joining us today. Russian President Vladimir Putin took a ride today on board a giant Tu-160M bomber. That's a supersonic plane that can carry a dozen cruise missiles, as well as a dozen short-range nuclear missiles.
After the flight and over the noise of jet engines, Putin told reporters that the bomber is a great addition to the Russian Air Force. The Russian leaders seem to be sending a not-so-subtle reminder to the West about his military's nuclear capabilities. The messaging comes as some Russian and U.S. diplomats say they cannot remember a time when relations between these two nuclear powers were worse. That rocky relationship was one of the topics we covered today with Victoria Nuland. She's the U.S. Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. I spoke with her earlier this afternoon. Undersecretary Nuland, President Biden warned Russia in 2021 that it would face devastating consequences if opposition leader Alexei Navalny were to die in prison. I know the White House is planning to release a new package of sanctions on Russia tomorrow, but so far sanctions have not forced the Kremlin to change course. What else can be done?
Well, as you know, Marco, sanctions take some time to work. These sanctions that we plan to introduce in the next couple of days are another crushing installment. They are particularly designed to deal with the fact that Russia has been somewhat effective at sanctions evasion. This is designed to close all of those gaps and make it much tougher for him to fuel his war machine, fuel his economy, and for the Russian people to feel the pinch from the decisions that he has made on their behalf and having sent them into this awful war that is doing nothing for them.
What about confiscating the $300 billion in frozen Russian bank reserves for the defense and reconstruction of Ukraine? Is Washington ready to take that step against Putin?
We certainly believe that that money needs to go in service of Ukraine. We are working on it with our allies and partners. We are working through a number of legal and financial issues, but I have every confidence that that money will be used for Ukraine.
I mean, there are 2 years of sanctions that we've seen. They seem to have done little. So how much longer until we do see impact?
You know, Marco, I just have to dispute the premise. You can't imagine how many more weapons and tools of war Putin would have been able to create if he hadn't had these sanctions on the whole military-industrial complex. As it is, he's having to go begging to Iran and North Korea and other pariah states for these kinds of things. And he's had to turn his whole economy in service of this war, again, starving the Russian people of a future.
Yeah, fair point. But Ukraine desperately needs now that assistance. What if the deadlock in Congress continues to not produce a decent aid package for Ukraine? Would that force the White House hand to take that step, transferring those frozen Russian assets, for example?
We're working on both at the same time. Ukraine needs the supplemental money that we have asked Congress for. It needs it on the battlefield. It needs it to keep its economy afloat. It needs it to rebuild the critical infrastructure that Putin has already taken down. But Ukraine also needs the frozen assets because it is going to be a long recovery effort. And as you can see, the taxpayers in the United States and in Europe want to ensure that Putin's money, not just our money, goes to support Ukraine.
The Russian capture of Avdiivka on Saturday could turn out to be a huge setback for Ukraine. Russia has momentum now on the battlefield in Kyiv. It's still waiting for renewed shipments of U.S. military aid. What is the estimate at the State Department of how long Ukraine's military can hold out?
Well, that's obviously a question for the Ukrainians and a question for the Pentagon, but we are gravely concerned when we have been unable to sustain the kinds of artillery and other assets that we've been giving Ukraine every couple of weeks at the level without the money that we need from this supplemental. You see what's happening on the battlefield. By some reports, there are Ukrainian soldiers that have 20 bullets a day to survive the kind of onslaught that Putin is meting out. And that's among the reasons why we really need Congress to pass this money now.
President Biden said he will not walk away from Ukraine, and neither will the American people. That's his quote. Why has it been so difficult for this administration to fulfill that promise?
Remember that in the U.S. Senate just last week, 70 senators voted in favor of this assistance. We are in intense conversations in the House of Representatives now. They are in intense conversations with themselves. American polling indicates that the American people understand the importance of supporting Ukraine, not only for its fight, but for the larger fight against autocrats and despots all over the world. So when the House comes back, we fully expect that members will look deeply into the future, and we hope that they will make the right decision, and we will marshal every argument so that they do.
The U.S. public may understand what's needed, but support has been waning for the Ukraine cause. GOP presidential contender Nikki Haley says it's because the Biden White House has not been able to explain to Americans why it's important to support Ukraine. Does she have a point?
You know, I think President Biden's been very clear from the beginning that this is obviously about Ukraine, about supporting its sovereignty and territorial integrity, and saying no to a big neighbor next door who just thinks that he can take a bite out of another country. Because if it happens in Ukraine, not only will Putin keep going, but other autocrats around the world will say, hey, it's open season for us to do the same thing. And that is not the kind of world Americans want to live in. And I fully expect that they will be telling their members of Congress that as well.
Finally, Undersecretary Nuland, on Gaza, the Israeli government is opposed to a two-state solution. There are Israeli leaders pushing for war with Hezbollah in Lebanon. They also want to rebuild settlements in Gaza and annex the West Bank. When should the U.S. acknowledge this growing gap in American and Israeli priorities?
We've been very clear from the beginning. The president's been very clear that even as Israel ensures that Hamas can never again mount the kind of attack it did on October 7th, that we need to keep this war from spreading. And we have been counseling all players that it must not spread in the north, it must not accelerate in the West Bank. And the president has been very clear with Prime Minister Netanyahu, and Secretary Blinken has with all Israeli leaders, that it is not in anybody's interest for this to get bigger. And most importantly, what we need to do is get urgently to a hostage deal, to a pause on the ground that can allow us to address some of these systemic problems, including providing an alternative for the Palestinian people to what Hamas is offering, and that's a two-state solution.
Victoria Nuland is the Undersecretary of State for Political Affairs. She joined us from the State Department in Washington. Overnight in the Gaza Strip, at least 48 people were killed in Israeli airstrikes. That's according to Palestinian health officials. They estimate the overall death toll in Gaza to be more than 29,400 people since October 7th when Hamas attacked Israel. More than half of Gaza's population is now crowded into the southern city of Rafah. Israeli leaders say they want the city evacuated ahead of a planned ground offensive to eradicate Hamas. Today, foreign ministers from 26 European countries called for a pause in the fighting, and they urged Israel not to take military action in Rafah. On Wednesday, the heads of 13 UN agencies and five other aid groups issued a joint statement calling for a ceasefire. They're warning that an attack in Rafah would bring mass casualties and could, quote, deal a death blow to aid operations there, an effort, they say, that is already on its knees.
The government in Venezuela has ordered United Nations officials to leave the country, accusing them of colonialist and abusive behavior. UN employees apparently crossed a line when they spoke up for Venezuelans detained for criticizing their government. As the world's TBS Isaiah reports, it could be a sign that Venezuela is intensifying a crackdown on political dissent ahead of presidential elections.
Rocío San Miguel had the courage to investigate the authoritarian regime of Nicolás Maduro and the armed forces from inside the country. Last week, she was arbitrarily detained at an airport in Venezuela by counterintelligence agents and disappeared for several days. Soon after, her daughter, two brothers, and two former partners also disappeared.
Hoy cualquiera puede ser Rocío.
Todas somos vulnerables.
Rocío no está.
Activists, politicians, and journalists in Venezuela and in the diaspora started a campaign on social media to demand answers. Days after, Attorney General Tarek William Saab addressed Venezuelans in a televised speech.
Buenas tardes, tengan todos ustedes, pueblo de Venezuela. El día de hoy,
he acknowledged Rocío San Miguel was being arrested by the Venezuelan government. He accused San Miguel of espionage and of participating in a conspiracy against Maduro. San Miguel's family members were freed, but she was sent to a notorious prison in Caracas called El Helicoide, which is known as a torture site. She hasn't had access to an independent lawyer. Genesis Davila is an attorney who represents victims of human rights violations in Venezuela.
El régimen, al detener a Rocío San Miguel, amenaza directamente.
She says Rocío San Miguel's arrest is a warning to dissident women, civil society, and the military.
Especialmente después de que casi 3 millones de venezolanos.
Especially, she says, this sends a message to Venezuela's strongest opposition leader, who is a woman. María Corina Machado won an opposition primary last fall with more than 80% of the vote. Now, the government disqualified her from running for office for alleged tax violations. In a recent event hosted in Washington, she said the Maduro regime has lost its social base.
And I think that Rocío San Miguel, brutal detention with her daughter, her family, this is a practice that the regime is doing selectively in order to create terror in a moment where it's critical for us to gain more and more momentum.
Several trusted polls show Maduro is highly unpopular. Presidential elections are due this year, but many expect they won't be democratic. David Smiley is with the Washington office on Latin America.
Venezuela is not a democracy. The Maduro government has strong control of the electoral institutions, all the basic institutions of the country, in that there's not likely to be a free and fair election in 2024.
Repression in Venezuela is nothing new. There are over 260 political prisoners in the country, according to the Venezuelan think tank Foro Penal. In 2021, the International Criminal Court greenlit an investigation into possible crimes against humanity in Venezuela. But the arrest of someone as high profile as San Miguel sends a more direct message, says Lexis Rendon. She runs a victim advocacy organization in Caracas called Peace Laboratory. We have fear, she says, that what happened to Rocío can happen to any of us and our family. But she says she's committed to continue working in Venezuela despite the fear. My commitment to the victims, she says, is what makes me wake up every day. For the world, I'm TBS Isaiah.
Whale songs have an iconic, haunting sound, but we know remarkably little about how whales make those sounds until now. That story is just ahead. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. If you put together a greatest hits album from the natural world, you would need to include this. Mm. underwater recordings captured the complexity and beauty of humpback whale songs more than 50 years ago. But the mechanism by which these creatures vocalize is only just being figured out. Magnus Valberg is part of the team that's done research on this. He's an associate professor at the University of Southern Denmark. Magnus, what was known up until this new research about how they made these songs?
So it's a very difficult topic to study, right? If you want to know how humans make sounds, you would probably put a camera into your throat and you would measure with some pressure sensors what's going on. And we can obviously not do that with these very big animals.
Another baleen whale is the minke whale. Let's listen to the recording of that whale made in the wild. This sounds so different from that humpback whale. Is it the same kind of vocal apparatus?
So that's a big surprise that even though all these baleen whales make rather low-pitched sounds, there's big diversity. So this is a minke whale call, and it's made with the same kind of sound apparatus. You also have the blue whale, the fin whale. They also make these kind of very low-frequency calls, and presumably then with exactly the same mechanisms.
And so you and your collaborators studied the voice boxes that were removed from the carcasses of three baleen whales. Those are those whales that filter feed instead of having teeth. What did you discover?
These are the really big, the biggest mammals ever living on the planet. And they are obviously very difficult to get hold of, but we had the opportunity then to get hold of three stranded specimens that were still in a very good condition. The problem is also once they strand and die, they decompose very rapidly. So you have to get hold of this tissue very rapidly. And we had some good networks with people to help us. And then we brought the larynx from these animals, so the voice box, to the lab. And we could then attach them to our measurement equipment and blow sound through them. And we could actually detect and document how sounds were actually coming out from the how the mechanics were of these voice boxes.
Can you describe how you tested the whale voice boxes that you were working with?
So we got the voice boxes from stranded individuals and we brought them to the lab, and then we hanged them up in an experimental device that we had constructed where we could pump in air through the voice box and then record sounds and use videos, and we also had accelerometers or motion sensors to understand how vibrations were created, and that led to this sound production.
And you had a balloon full of air, basically, that you pushed through these voice boxes.
Yeah, so one of the challenges was to create airflow that was enough, and the way we did that was to have a huge air balloon that we could squeeze and in that way create a steady airflow that was massive enough to make the larynx sing.
So let's hear one of those tests now. So what are we hearing there?
It takes some experience to decipher what's going on here, but it's actually the sound made by this larynx when you blow air through it. And of course, it doesn't sound like a perfect minke whale, but if you analyze this in detail, you can actually understand the function of sound production, and the sound has the features and components needed for actual sound production. But actual sound production in a live animal involves not only your vocal folds and blowing air through them, it also involves a lot of different muscles. It's a very fine mechanism where that steers the tension of the voice box and so on, and so to generate different types of sounds. So it's very difficult to reproduce the actual sounds made by a live animal by doing these kind of experiments. But we can at least confirm that we have all the components needed for a minke whale to make its sounds.
So can you describe what these voice boxes look like and how they work?
Yeah, so the first impression when you dissect one out is how big they are, right? So these animals, we're talking about up to 50 feet animals in length. So the voice box in these animals, they weigh several tens of metric tons, the whole animal. And the voice box itself, you know, it's big as a medium-sized dog. It's a big lump of tissue.
Big as a medium-sized dog, you said?
Yeah, I think it was something like, you know, 20, 30 pounds or something like that.
When you, you know, were working with these real whale voice boxes and running air through them to create sound, were you surprised by how they worked or what it sounded like?
Well, I was quite surprised. So my expertise is mainly on. I'm mainly doing field recordings of whales. I'm often out and recording them and trying to understand what they say to each other. So my real expertise is not in these sound production organs. But my part of this study was really to help the main author, Professor Elements, to get hold of the tissues and to set up the experiments and so on. So this was actually one of the first times when I was experiencing these kind of experiments live. And I must say I was quite surprised because it was quite a big setup that Elements had to make this happen. And in the middle of this huge setup, you had this big larynx that we hooked up with all the measurement devices, film cameras and so on. And when he started to blow air through it and started to manipulate this big chunk of tissue, it started to sound like a whale. So that was a pretty amazing experience, actually.
So what conclusions was your team able to draw from this research?
So, I mean, a major conclusion is that, the only way we have been able to understand how baleen whales make sounds is from anatomical investigation. So this is the first time when we can actually present how these tissues function. One of the things with whales is that they have lungs. They are mammals, so they have to come out to the surface and breathe, and then they collect air, and that's the air they have to make sounds. And the deeper they dive, the smaller this air volume will be because it will be compressed. So at a certain depth, there will simply not be air enough to drive the vocal organ. And we could actually make some modeling and some predictions at which depth this system will stop functioning. Mm. And the surprising, and that was a major surprise for me who work with the behavior of these animals, to see that we could actually predict that at a couple of hundred meters or, you know, maybe 400 or 500 feet or so, they would not be able to produce sounds anymore.
Well, vocalizations are important to their survival. They're used for what? Echolocation, communication, mating. What more does this research tell us about their ability to survive in our modern oceans with lots of noise pollution?
Yes, I think it gives some extra information to this whole debate about noise pollution, because one issue with a lot of the noise we generate in the waters nowadays comes from ships and other activities rather close to the surface. So you could say that if the whales are constrained to make sounds in the upper layers of the oceans, this will be also the most noisy part of the ocean. And there is a great overlap between the frequencies produced by boats and shipping and the sounds that whales are making. And whales are making sounds very much like birds do. They do it both to communicate between one another, but a very important function with these sounds is to simply sing and display and to find a mate and so on and so forth. And if they are then masked by shipping noise, that could generate some problems for them.
That's Magnus Valberg. He's a professor of marine bioacoustics at the University of Southern Denmark. He's been telling us about new research into the voice box of baleen whales, including the humpback whale. We've got more global news and stories still ahead for you this hour. You're listening to The World.
U.S. law enforcement is accusing a Japanese Yakuza leader of trying to sell nuclear material on the black market. We'll hear from one Yakuza expert who says trafficking and that sort of thing would be an entirely new operation for Japan's well-known organized crime gangs.
There is no record of the Yakuza dealing in nuclear materials.
That story's still ahead here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. It's been nearly 2 years since the start of Russia's full-scale invasion. And for kids in Ukraine, life now looks a lot different than it did before the war. All across the country, whenever air raid sirens go off during the school day, students and teachers run to bomb shelters for safety. Kharkiv, in the northeast, is Ukraine's second largest city and not far from the Russian border. The World's Daniel Offman visited one school there that's found a way to keep kids safe while they're learning.
Deep underground Kharkiv is the city's metro system. When Russia began its full-scale invasion and bombarded the city, these stations were used by thousands of residents as bomb shelters. Today, Russia is still targeting Kharkiv. And because of that, most school children in the city are getting their education online. But not here. This fall, Kharkiv launched an underground school system. And one of the locations is the Perimoha metro station. They transformed offices into classrooms, improved ventilation, and put up colorful posters. Now more than 2,000 students attend classes at 5 different locations within the city's metro system.
Some of the kids who are here for school are running around the metro station playing tag, just being kids. I mean, this is school for them, but this is also a place for them to play and to just have fun and not really think about what's going on outside.
When school starts, an administrator walks into one of the first grade classrooms. "I'm glad to see you," she says. Then she asks, "What class is this?"
Англійська мова. Молодці, які подобається вивчати англійську мову.
The kids say it's English class. One of those kids is 7-year-old Katya Rybalka. She wears her blonde hair in a bun and sports a Princess Elsa shirt. When I ask her to say something in English, she says a word that I sense is important to her.
Можеш что-то сказать по-английски? Да.
Dog.
Катя says that her family has a puppy named Richie.
Догонялки. Річ мене догоняє, я на кровать запригую.
She says Richie chases after me, so I jump up on the bed. As for school, Katya says she likes it here. She's from the Kharkiv region, but over the last 2 years, her family has had to move multiple times. She says her family explained to her why they had to move. Well, because the war started and Russia started hitting us. She says the moves were hectic. There was a lot of stuff and a lot of people.
Бабушка, дедушка, моя двоюродна сестра, собака, наша
She lists
мама,
all the family members that fled together, дедушка, her parents, grandparents, cousins, and her dog. She says her parents were worried, but that she wasn't.
А я вообще просто мультики дивилася і не волновалась.
I just watched cartoons and I didn't worry. But the war does impact kids on many levels. And Katya's English teacher, Vyacheslav Timofeyev, says returning to in-person school has been critical.
It is very beneficial for them to have a live communication with adults, with their with children of their age. And this is right for their socialization and future, I guess.
Timofeyev says that along with teaching in the subway, many other things have changed over the last 2 years, including hearing students talk about war. Timofeyev teaches grades 1 through 4.
They talk about it pretty much very often. We do hear it from time to time.
How do kids talk about war?
Well, you know, I guess they do not pay too much emotions in that. They don't have, you know, any hatred or any particular fear. I don't see that they are afraid of something. They just talk about it like it's a normal stuff.
The war sometimes comes up in class, Timofeyev says, in ways that are unexpected.
We had a task, they should have drawn some pictures, their favorite toys, you know, something like that. Boys mostly, of course, they drew tanks. And when I asked why is a tank your favorite toy, he said that to kill enemies.
Timofeyev says he's seen other changes in the students since coming back in person last fall.
They were very quiet, you know. Even now, half a year later, we have some children that almost don't speak. I guess it's a challenge for psychologists, yeah, who work with them, because we have a group of psychologists that work here. They try to help.
In the Kharkiv underground school system, every class has a psychologist.
Ми перебуваємо з дітками весь час. Ми зустрічаємо.
We're with the students all the time, says Victoria Fidyanina, one of the psychologists. We greet them in the morning, we're with them in class, during breaks, and all day until they go back home to their parents. Fidyanina says that the younger kids are going through an adjustment period. They've missed a lot of school, both because of the pandemic and then because of the war.
Багато хто з дітей скаржився на те, що погано спав вночі.
Many of the kids don't sleep well at night, Fidyanina says. There are air raid sirens, and some of them hear explosions. They need to run to the bomb shelter in the middle of the night, so they're tired once they get to school in the morning. Fidyanina also says that many of the kids' families had to move here from other parts of the country. Some of their parents are in the military. In some cases, a parent may have been killed in the war.
6 років потрібно сміятися, грати, стрибати, радіти, і ми намагаємося оцю.
At 6 years old, you're supposed to laugh,
play, jump, and just be happy, Fidyanina says. And we're trying to give them an opportunity to have a childhood. That opportunity has not been lost on ninth grader Anastasia Doroshenko.
It's some special, interesting feeling when I go to school in underground, because before the war, I used underground like some kind of transport. And now it's special feeling. I don't even know exactly how to explain it. So it's some feeling of miracle.
While Doroshenko loves her new school, she says the war has changed the way she looks at life.
Before the war, I thought that the world is maybe more kind, but now you don't have such opinion.
Doroshenko says that over the past 2 years, she remembers three times when there were big explosions near her home. She says each time she thought she could die, and that's had an impact.
I think I became more realistic, and I understand that every time can maybe bad or some explodes. So I think I started to appreciate life more. I understand that the most important thing is people.
Even though the war is ever present, Doroshenko says it's not the only thing she and her friends talk about at school.
I like so much subjects. I like biology, English, Ukrainian language, literature. I know definitely that it wouldn't be connected with math, because I don't like math. I am searching.
For a moment, Doroshenko sounds like a ninth grader would sound anywhere else in the world. Just a kid complaining about math and thinking about what her future could look like. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman, Kharkiv, Ukraine.
To get a glimpse of what it's like to go to school in Kharkiv's underground metro and see more of Daniel's reporting from Ukraine, visit theworld.org.
In an indictment announced yesterday, the U.S. Justice Department is naming Takeshi Ebisawa as a leader of the Japanese Yakuza Mafia and accusing him of trying to sell nuclear material from Myanmar to Iran. The DOJ was not available to comment. We reached out to Martina Baradell, who studies Japanese organized crime at the University of Oxford in the U.K. She says that Ebisawa's connections to the Yakuza are not yet clear.
There has been no confirmation that he is part of the Yakuza. The police didn't confirm it, and not even other people who are connected with the Yakuza. Nobody knows him. So it seems a little bit strange that he's a Yakuza leader, yet nobody knows him.
To your knowledge, have the Yakuza ever been involved in trafficking nuclear material before?
No, they haven't been involved. The Yakuza, for a very long time, has been a very insular operation. They have been operating mainly within the borders of Japan. And of course, in the past couple of decades, there have been quite a few cases of Yakuza members going abroad, especially Southeast Asia, to conduct some business. But there is no record of the Yakuza dealing in nuclear materials, no.
I mean, I'm curious to know, I mean, what does it tell you that Ebisawa, regardless of whether he is a Yakuza or not, was allegedly working on behalf of an insurgent group in Myanmar and was apparently ready and willing to sell nuclear material to Iran?
I mean, he was working as a broker, apparently. So he was mediating between different groups. And apparently he's been active, especially in Thailand, for around, I think, 20 years, dealing with a lot of criminal groups. And it was not only about nuclear materials anyway. I think that drugs, methamphetamines in particular, were involved as well. So it is very possible that he would, you know, operate as a broker for all kinds of criminal operations.
Had you ever heard of Takeshi Ebisawa?
I've heard the first time about him 2 years ago, because I remember this very iconic picture of him with a bazooka, I think. So when he was arrested in 2022, that became very famous. But also at that time, nobody came forward to say that he is a Yakuza. And that is why I have doubts about it, because he could have changed his name. But the fact that this picture is out and his face is very recognizable means that somebody would have, you know, kind of stepped up to say that they know them. And the only people who have done that so far in Japanese news reports are people who say that he is a fraudster, but no one coming up to say that he's a member of the Yakuza.
What are the Yakuza crime gangs involved in these days in Japan and internationally?
So the Yakuza mainly operates in Japan. So Yakuza operating in big cities like Tokyo have very different businesses than Yakuza operating in the countryside. But in general, we can say that the Yakuza deals with legal, semi-legal and illegal activities. So, of course, legal activities are mainly connected with the nighttime entertainment, the construction sector. When I say semi-legal, I mean gambling and illegal, of course, drugs, weapons, prostitution. But I would say that one of their core businesses is, of course, protection of the market. So getting money from establishments to provide private protection to them.
Martina Baradell studies Japanese organized crime at the University of Oxford in the UK. She was reacting to a U.S. Justice Department indictment that accuses a leader of the Japanese Yakuza of trying to sell nuclear materials to Iran.
Argentina's economy was already in crisis when the far-right populist Javier Milei took over as president in December.
Sabemos que de corto plazo la situación empeorará, pero luego veremos los frutos.
In his first presidential address, Milei said his plans for economic reforms would be painful in the short term. Keeping to that promise, he has slashed government spending, removed key subsidies, and devalued Argentina's currency. That's caused inflation to surge. Argentina finished 2023 with an annual inflation rate above 200%. From Buenos Aires, Lotario Grinspan reports on how people are coping.
Villa Fiorito is a poor, working-class city on the outskirts of Buenos Aires. 6 days a week, a group of locals gather on the side of a road near a mural of hometown hero Diego Maradona, the soccer legend. People come here to barter, trading household goods for food to put on the table. That's Patricia Nutz. She tells me that she comes to this neighborhood feria, or fair, to trade clothes her family doesn't need anymore for things like sugar, oil, or pasta. Nutz works at a food market and cleans houses on the side, but she still says she needs to barter to get by. Because of runaway inflation, she can no longer afford what she once did. Before, her pantry was full, she says. Now, it's empty. Before, she could have lunch and dinner. Now, she has to choose. Scenes like the bartering feria in Villa Fiorito are regularly playing out in towns across the Buenos Aires metro area. On Facebook, bartering groups are taking off, helping people advertise things they are willing to trade. Ariel Vega is a Buenos Aires resident who administers a local Facebook bartering group, which he created during the throes of the pandemic. He says his group had around 4,000 members when Milei became president 2 months ago. Now he has over 9,000. Nowadays, most people in the group are on the lookout for food, he says. Food prices alone rose by 30% in December and by an additional 20% in January. Incomes aren't keeping up, says Joaquin Waldman, an economist and researcher in Buenos Aires. Purchasing power is at a 20-year low.
Con una caída tan grande del salario real, es inevitable ir hacia una recesión.
Analysts like Waldman agree that the steps Milei has taken early in his presidency to reduce public expenditures will hurt consumer spending and lead to a recession. But whether Milei made the right call with the pace and scope of his austerity approach is up for debate. Back at the bartering feria in Villa Fiorito, Luz Lopez set out a blanket with clothes, toys, and perfume vials. She says her water and electric bills have gone up. The cost of a bus ticket is now 9 times higher after Milei reduced subsidies for public transportation. Milei took everything away. People can't take it anymore, she says. Even her son, 7-year-old Dylan, chimes in. People don't have anything to eat, he says. Everything is expensive. Javier Augero is an Argentine professor of sociology at the University of Texas in Austin. He says there's a long tradition of bartering in Argentina.
The poor, the urban poor in particular, have always relied on a combination of what we could call strategies of survival. These interpersonal networks of reciprocal help have always been around, and they become even more prominent during these times of crisis.
Angelo says he hears that toilet paper has gotten so expensive that people are teaming up to buy it in bulk. Some are also exploring other alternatives.
A resident of La Matera, which is a very poor squatter settlement in the southern part of Buenos Aires, was telling my co-author yesterday that, you know, after 7 years of her broken bidet, she finally got her act together and finally fixed it because the toilet paper was becoming so expensive.
Turning to neighbors for help weathering the current crisis is a strategy whose usefulness could run out. That's because over 40% of the country is living in poverty, according to official data. A recent study shows millions more have become poor since Milei took over.
It's almost half of the country, right? So you need to put that in perspective that, you know, there's so much you can barter, there's so much you can exchange when everybody is suffering this.
In Argentina, there's worry that discontent over the effects of Milei's policies could lead to social upheaval. Even though public opinion polls show the president continues to enjoy broad support, mass protests have already erupted. Patricia Nutz isn't sure what will happen. She tells me it would be fair to give the new president some time and to give his economic approach a chance. But she also says she wouldn't be surprised if Milei lasts less than 1 year in office. He's messing with poor people's pocketbooks too much, she says. For The World, I'm Lautaro Greenspan, Buenos Aires.
Coming up on the show, the dystopian landscape of China's property crisis. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. In Shenyang City, about 400 miles northeast of Beijing, there is a huge housing development with rows and rows of mansions, more than 100 of them. Each one is unfinished and uninhabited. It's a giant ghost town.
What lies here now is a skeleton of a housing project that began construction in 2010, but came to a halt a few years later. Its gardens have been taken over by farmers herding goats into makeshift pens. The abandoned homes are a testament to a property crisis long in the making.
That's from a video report by the Wall Street Journal's China Bureau Chief Jonathan Cheng. I spoke with him earlier about how that stalled housing project in Shenyang is just one of many all across China.
It was like you're on a movie set with, you know, these hulking shells of buildings, some of them pretty close to finished with wallpaper and, you know, fixings and concrete, you know, all laid and marble and so on. And other ones were pretty bare bones still. But it was incredible to see hundreds of these homes sitting in the snow, just empty and abandoned and will probably never be finished.
Yeah, your reporting found that 20 million pre-sold homes are now sitting empty. What happened with the real estate market to get to this point?
There was a big building boom to basically fuel China's rise. And you saw this happen basically over the course of decades. And, you know, you see the phenomenon in the U.S. and in other countries as well, where people get this fever about them. They know people who have made a lot of money because they bought early and nobody wants to miss the train. And so everyone else gets buying and that fuels its own sort of rise. And next thing you know, you have a real estate bubble. And so China for decades never really addressed this. They talked about addressing it, but they never really did anything about it. And that changed about 2 or 3 years ago when you have the government say, no, we're really going to stop property developers from just borrowing money, in some cases, just taking pre-sale money from home buyers who were basically handing over cash on the expectation that these homes would be finished. And when the bottom fell out because of this government regulation, you just had a lot of developers who just didn't have the money to finish.
So who's the biggest loser in this story? Is it the families that invested in these homes and are never going to get to live in them? Is it these real estate companies that have now defaulted on all their debt?
it may be too obvious to say, but I think all of the above is the answer. And you could even put the government in there too, because by the government, I mean not just the central government in Beijing, but I also mean every provincial, city, municipal government. They were relying on land sales for a lot of the revenue. So if they were funding their hospitals or their schools or their public services, a lot of that was being funded by money that came from property developers. And now all of that has stopped. And obviously, when you take an industry that by most economists' estimates was accounting for about 25% of China's overall GDP, you take a lot of that away. Actually, the hit is going to be felt by everyone in China, and in fact, will be felt around the world.
I want to stay in China and ask you, you know, what is the ripple effect within China's economy to this real estate bubble burst?
Well, I mean, like anywhere else, you have home builders who, if they're not building homes, there's not going to be as much economic activity. You're not going to need as much cement. You're not going to need as much steel. People are not going to be buying as many refrigerators and appliances. And people won't be buying as many vehicles, and it just pulls everyone else down with them.
So what happens to those families who've invested in these properties? Are they just out the cash, or is there anything they can do?
Obviously, if you are a wealthier person, and this is your fourth or your fifth home or something like that, I suppose you can absorb it. But yes, you don't have a lot of legal recourse. The most you can do in China is you can try and protest, but we know that protesting is not always going to work in China. In fact, it rarely works. But the pain is so widespread here that with some of these developers, you have had scenes of people essentially mobbing the headquarters of these developers, even though they, I think, know in their heart of hearts how hopeless that is. But when that is your blood, sweat, and everything else that you've toiled for, you can't just let it go. And so I think it has led to a lot of pain and a lot of resentment across China.
You mentioned that the Chinese government was very slow to address the real estate bubble. Now that the bottom has fallen out in the market, what are they doing to address this stage of the problem?
They also sort of created it, and to their credit, they have dealt with the bubble, but now they sort of have the opposite problem right now, which is they may have dealt with it too firmly. And what we haven't seen is really meaningful steps towards putting the real estate market and the economy more broadly on a steadier footing. It's one thing to say we don't want to see a real estate bubble. It's another thing to see the real estate market collapse. And so what a lot of economists have said is you need to support the developers that you, the government, have spent the last few years trying to rein in, and you're going to have to throw them a lifeline.
Back to the larger implications of what's happening in China, what does this mean for the U.S. right now, given that the American and Chinese economies are so deeply intertwined?
Despite the amount of geopolitical tension and mistrust between Washington and Beijing, this Cold War, if you want to call it that, is characterized by much deeper integration of the two countries' economies, to the degree where I think many economists would say that there is no way to really disentangle them. If you think about the iPhone that you're probably using, that doesn't really happen without China. Of course, there has been a shift by Apple and by many other companies to shift production to India and to Vietnam, but it is a slow process, and China is still just really deeply integrated. So when China takes a big hit, as it has because of this real estate slowdown, it will be felt everywhere.
Jonathan Chang is the China Bureau Chief for the Wall Street Journal. He spoke with me from Beijing.
In other news from China today, more pandas will soon be sent to the U.S. China, as you may recall, called home three pandas last fall. They'd been on loan to the National Zoo in Washington. Panda diplomacy is sometimes seen as a barometer for U.S.-China relations, and those three were a topic of conversation when President Biden met Chinese President Xi in California shortly after the animals were returned to their country of birth. At the time, U.S. Ambassador to China Nick Burns tipped us off that other pandas could be coming.
Well, it was interesting. I was at the dinner last evening here in San Francisco where President Xi spoke, and at the end of his remarks, he said that China wanted to make it possible to have pandas in California, and he mentioned San Diego, I assume at the San Diego Zoo. So I think it's a good step forward.
And now that step forward is official. The San Diego Zoo has signed an agreement with the China Wildlife Conservation Association to bring two bears to that zoo as early as this summer. Chinese officials also sealed a deal with a zoo in Madrid. Pandas were once on the brink of extinction, but decades of conservation efforts have boosted their numbers from fewer than 1,000 to more than 1,800 panda bears in the wild and in captivity.
The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. As always, thank you for listening.
From PRX.